So it's Sunday afternoon, and I just started reading Maureen Dowd's latest New York Times opinion piece, The Florida Fraudster and the Russian Killer. And I want to share the lead, because I feel every word. When I covered George H.W. Bush's presidential campaign in 1988, he was so eager to wrap himself in the American flag that he took us to a New Jersey flag factory. That way, he could claim that the GOP was on the American side, while caressing pieces of striped red and white nylon. At the time, it seemed like a cynical move by Republicans trying to bogart patriotism, but at least they respected our country enough to try to monopolize its symbol. That vanishing breed of Republican pledged allegiance to the American flag. Now Republicans pledge allegiance to Donald Trump's ego. He has to be bigger than everything, even America itself. Bush wrapped himself in the American flag, David Axelrod said. Trump wants to wrap himself in the Mar-a-Lago flag. Just as Trump has remade the Republican Party in his own nasty and selfish image, he wants to remake America in his own nasty and selfish image. Trump doesn't seem to subscribe to any of the verities about this country. He doesn't believe America is exceptional. He only believes that Trump is exceptional, an exception to all the rules that the rest of us live by. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Louisa Thomas, the exceptional New Yorker staff writer whose recent piece, How Nikolai Jokic Became the World's Best Basketball Player, is absolute gold. This is episode number 352. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks, and your face looks like a bowl of cereal that's been left in the sun for too long.
All right, Louisa Thomas, thank you for doing this. Very much appreciated. I want to have a quick rap battle with you. We've tried arranging this before, and you've always had some sort of child-based chaos in your life.
Yes.
Right now, as we speak, I'm sitting in my closet. I was going to do this in a different room, but I have my niece, my sister-in-law and her husband staying with us. I tried recording in another room. I heard the shower in the other room, then went into my son's room, but my son's room smells like the body odor of a 17-year-old boy, which is appropriate. So I am back in my closet next to my underwear and a pile of laundry. What do you have?
Well, let's see. It's been a week. On Monday, they announced that my daughter's school was closed. And also my son's daycare was closed. I have a one-year-old and a six-year-old. I actually had to teach on Tuesday morning, which meant I had to move it to Zoom. And then like I tried with the one-year-old in my lap, and it's a three-hour class. And 20 minutes into it hit like a total meltdown. I was just like, I give up, everybody go. That's kind of like what my life is like these days.
You're not sitting in your closet.
I'm not sitting in my closet. I'm sitting in my office, which is actually my bedroom. So.
All right, that's pretty good. All right, so I've wanted to have you on here a long time, and this is a good actual, this is a good time to do it, because you just wrote a story that absolutely, absolutely fascinates me, everything about it, construction, approach, etc. How Nikola Jokic became the world's best basketball player. Subhead was, he doesn't run very fast or jump very high and seems to prefer the company of horses, but he has mastered the game's new geometry like nobody else. It appeared in the New Yorker. I thought the story was fantastic. You are really, really, really good at writing about people with limited access, sometimes no access, viewing from afar. Do you just, in a weird way, do you approach every story assuming you are not going to have much access?
Well, this one, I knew I was not going to have access. He doesn't give access to anyone. And now I'm thinking, yeah, is it Nikola or Nikola?
Bob.
But I couldn't ask him, you know? I mean, I did go to, you know, press conferences and such. But yeah, I knew, because he doesn't give access to anyone. And in a way, that was kind of liberating. I get assignments all the time for stories that I end up not being able to write because, you know, so-and-so NBA star says, yeah, we'll do it if we get out of the cover. And I'm like, well, the cover this week is a doodle of a poodle. So sorry about that. And that's sort of a hard, like, reality is that the New Yorker likes to have access. It considers itself a magazine of considerable repute, and it doesn't really want, you know, my editors don't really want to see the story that we do if, you know, if the subject doesn't talk to us, but does talk to like the New York Times Magazine or even like appears on the cover of GQ the following month. So that's often actually a big challenge for me in particular, because an academic or a, you know, a you know, a tech person or a, you know, someone from culture, they love to, you know, be profiled by the New Yorker, but a lot of athletes are like, what? So I went into this and actually pitched it as a story without access. I have various strengths as a writer and reporter, and I have weaknesses like we all do. I actually don't particularly enjoy the process of, you know, chasing someone around with a notebook in hand, shadowing them, as we say, trying to sit down with them for a long time. It's not really what I'm like most, neither what I'm comfortable doing, nor am I particularly like good at it, I think, actually. So in some ways I found it liberating writing this story because I could just like watch, actually, you know, I could lean into watching from a distance. I have no problem like picking up the phone and calling people. So I'm, you know, happy to do reporting and interviews, but that sort of like that, it often becomes both by necessity and just by, you know, the fact that you have it, like that kind of interview process often becomes the centerpiece of a profile, and not having that there, I found kind of, yeah, I found it somewhat liberating. you know, I wrote a piece about Daniel Bard, the pitcher for the Colorado Rockies over the summer. And that I actually talked to him hours and hours and hours. Like I would call him, you know, a couple times a week, and we would chat when I was in the carpool line pickup. And my transcript, you know, my edited transcript of the interview was like 150 pages. That was the edited transcript. And so I was sort of like dealing with the opposite issue. And I liked that too. Like I find it hardest when you have just a little, you know, because you feel constrained by that. If you have a lot, that's amazing. If you have nothing, like I can work with that. It's like having like the one kind of like bad interview that I sort of struggle with.
I feel like when I was at Sports Illustrated, if I pitched this story, my editors would say, well, are you going to try to talk to him? And I'd say, sure, I'll try to talk to him. I'll call his agent. His agent would say, no, he's not doing interviews. My editor would say, well, go to the Nuggets locker room every day and stand by his locker and maybe follow him to his car and walk with him and blah, blah, blah. And eventually I would get those five sentences with Jokic, and my editor would feel like they could check off a box, like you did your job. And I'd be sort of annoyed. You feel none of that pressure whatsoever, correct?
In this instance? No, because I also knew that his, you know, privacy, his sort of need for, you know, to keep the media at arm's distance was like actually part of the story. And so in a way, like what I wanted to communicate in the story was like partly just the way he played basketball and the pleasure in that. And then something of his personality. And I didn't feel like I needed to hound him to get that. And I also felt like if I got enough from the rest of the world, you know, around him, then that would be enough. You know, like, I don't think it would have worked if no one had talked to me, you know, but it turned out like there are lots of people who want to talk about Nikola Jokic. Everybody wants to talk about it. You know, there were interviews I couldn't get. I wanted to talk to Shaquille O'Neal and he said yes, but then he had an emergency allergy appointment, as Shaquille O'Neal does, you know, things like that. You know, some things don't work out, but a lot of people were just like happy to talk about him, and they talked about him in interesting ways. And it's, you know, it wasn't a long piece. And I just felt like, yeah, I never was like going to feel like the piece didn't work out if I didn't, you know, if I didn't have that, those five sentences, you know, those five lines for him. But again, like it might be different if I were writing about, you know, another great basketball player, you know, someone like Giannis, you know, who does talk to the press. I think I would have to get some more kind of like intimate interview or conversation with him. I would have to do that thing where I stand by the locker until I get what I needed, because what he kind of projects is a kind of like almost empathetic connection between, he has this sort of like charisma that is very different than Jokic. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't work to sort of pretend that he keeps people at an arm's distance, almost the opposite. So like, you kind of have to read the subject, I think, and sort of say like, well, what's, you know, not that I knew what the piece was going to say when I went into it, but I had a sense of like, how are you going to match the subject with the form? And that's always for me, like one of the biggest questions going into any story. And so for this one, I didn't, you know, that was not an anxiety I had. It just wasn't. And I mean, maybe I'm flattering myself, but I didn't finish thinking like, oh, if only I got that, you know, one like walk, you know, walk through or whatever they call it, you know, walk with or whatever.
Yeah.
Outside the locker room. If I'd only gotten that, then the piece would have been made. And, you know, I didn't worry about it.
You're expressing something I've actually never thought of, and I'm kind of embarrassed that I've never thought of it before. In a way, what you're saying, but tell me if I'm wrong, is the way you write the story, and in a way, the way a story is structured, you sort of want it to reflect the personality of the player. And I don't just mean that the story reflects the personality of the player, but you actually, in a way, want the structure and makeup of the story to reflect the personality of the player.
No, I want everything about the story. I want the language. I want the, you know, tone. I want the structure. I mean, I really believe in the kind of like the most effective stories. Everything is kind of a piece, you know, everything is sort of like, there's this kind of, I mean, I wish I could look it up, but like, you want the rhythm, you want the sense, you want the tone, you want everything, the structure to like build to some effect. And it's often like an emotional and a kind of almost a subterranean effect, as much as it is like a kind of the effect of learning information about a person. And often that's done through these kind of like, in these like writerly ways, as much through like an interesting conversation with someone. Yeah, I think about all those things when I'm thinking about the structure, or when I'm thinking about, you know, tone or whatever. And sometimes it works and sometimes it probably doesn't, you know. I might get carried away sometimes.
The efforts to do that actually drive me crazy. I remember Gary Smith, the old SI writer, saying like, every word matters. Every word matters. It's not just like, there are no throwaway words. Mm-hmm. And when you start taking that as a philosophy, you really start losing your mind, because you start worrying about words missing. And if you're worried about having a story that flows in the way of the person you're writing about, it must kind of drive you a little bonkers, no?
In the beginning, it does. Okay, so one thing that I am, maybe this is a survival skill, but I'm not like Gary Smith. Like, I'm actually a super easy edit, because at some point I let go of the story to some extent, you know, because I also consider myself like a professional person with a job. And at some point I like accept that like there's a certain word limit. It has to fit on the page or fit, you know, and also like I'm a collegial person. Like there's at some point, like on a draft, I'm like agonizing over every line. And then through the first edit too, I'm just like, oh, you can't change that. And like, often it's for these kind of reasons that only I have, which is like the rhythm of that, you know, or the sound of that, or like the way that echoes, you know, this earlier line here. And like, I have these kind of like very developed reasons for every line I have in a story. And it's like just so painful to sort of see that go. But also, like, I also have a really long relationship with my editor and, you know, with the magazine, the other people there. So I actually just like do trust them at some point, you know, and later in the process, I'm just like, sure, yep, gone, you know, like take, accept. And it's not even like exhaustion. I just, I'm like, I'm not precious about it. And I also feel like if you've done a good job in the beginning, if you've sort of communicated something about the essence, then everybody else is picking up on it too, you know, and you know it best, like you refine it, you know, you take their edits or whatever, and you like make them your own. But at some point, like it's all on the surface. Everyone's on the surface of the same thing, which is the thing you've made and the thing and the subject also. So in that sense, like it becomes just easy to sort of like get into the flow of just like revising and refining. And I don't actually think it's like actually very productive for me and for the story to get too hung up on any given word, because like, yeah, if at that point, if like a word is going to make or break a story, like you've done something wrong, you know?
Yeah. Wow, that's really good. Years ago, when she was a very young writer, I don't know if you know the writer Mirren Fader, who writes for The Ringer, but Mirren came to me. She was writing for the Orange County Register, and she did a piece about a coach at Chapman University and her background and blah, 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 blah. And she's like, the editors ruined it. They butchered it. They ruined it. And I said to her, I said, I guarantee you, this woman, this coach, is going to be so thrilled that her story is being told in the Orange County Register that her and her friends are just going to say to you, wow, what an amazing story. I really love being profiled. No, you don't understand. They killed it. And she called me a week later and she's like, yeah, you were right. Like, like you, I agonize over every word. But as I've gotten older, I realize like most people don't even give a shit about that agony, or nobody cares.
I also think like there's a little bit, I always give myself like 20 minutes when I get an edit back to sort of like slam my laptop shut, like 20 minutes long, but like 5 minutes, like rage, you know, I tell like my husband how like stupid people are and like nobody understands anything and like, you know, it's ruined. I can't even publish it. Maybe I should try and get it killed. And, you know, like, and then like calm down, you know, and then open it up and then start going through it and start like, yes, there are some things that I want to set and here's why. And then there's some things that I want to refine and here's why. But a lot of it is like, okay, that's reasonable. Like, you know, and you sort of get back into the flow. And I don't know, it always, I was a fact checker actually first. And that like obviously taught me a lot of important lessons about, you know, truth, but also about, you know, reporting and things like that. But one of the other things that like the skill that it helped me develop is that like the person that you're responsible to is like not the subject, you know, it's not the writer. It's not like some like concept of art, you know, it's just like truth and the reader. And whatever the story is supposed to be, like, there's no kind of like, you can't be too precious about anything. Like, you just have to get it right. And yeah. So like, you have to let go of your ego. The point is like, when you're a fact checker, you like, you learn to like, you see these writers and you see like, and I'm telling you, I don't mean to throw any writer on the bus. Cause like, I'm one of them now, you know, mm-hmm. But like, they're so like caught up in their egos, you know? And you sort of have to like, you just sort of like learn to like, just like, that's not why you're doing this. Like, get over it. Or they're so caught up in like, their fascination with the subject, you know, and they feel like some duty to like tell a certain thing. And if you don't include that, then like the subject is going to be disappointed. I mean, not that any New Yorker writer would say that, but you get that, you know, that's a human thing, right? Or there's some fact that's so amazing that that's going to be the thing that people remember. And maybe it will be, you know, but like, you just got to like save that for the next story or something, but you just sort of like, you don't get like a fact checker. Like it helped me learn not to be like, actually too attached to anything as long except to being like right.
So do you feel like you skip, because you were a fact checker, you skip the douchebaggy writer phase or no?
Oh no. I mean, I'm totally a douchebaggy writer. Like it's just like deep in. There's no, but it did allow me to like, there's like a voice in me, you know, that like I have like a little conscience, you know, sitting on one shoulder telling me not to be such a jerk. I was also an editor, that also helps. You know, it was funny because like when I was an editor, I was like, God, writers don't understand. Like they file really late in the night and they don't understand there's like someone waiting for their copy, right? Who has like not only to edit it, but to like, you know, it was a website. I was working at Grantland. So it's like build the, you know, post and do all the like dumb, you know, captions and headlines and box checking and, you know, hyperlinking and all this like stuff that just takes a long time. And the writer is like, oh, like here I filed, the work is done, you know? And like, I was like, I'm never gonna, when I go back to being a writer full time. But even while I was being an editor, I was writing and I was doing that to my own editor, you know? Even as I was like, knew what I was putting him through, I was like, well, I guess it's hard. I guess writing is hard. So it's good to have it's good to have all that kind of like, it just is good to have like certain checks on your worst instincts, which are also your best instincts, because that's also what produces good work.
I just want to say, I think everyone goes through they just shouldn't run it. They just shouldn't run it. I'm just going to give it to someone else. Yeah. Don't run it.
I like actively, my last piece I wrote, I actively tried to kill it. I was like, nope, it's just not, it's just in my head. You know, it's fine. You know?
I want to go back to Jokic here. You wrote in the piece, you wrote, traditionally a basketball team is organized into discrete parts. The tallest man fights for control near the rim, waiting to be fed passes for close range baskets. Guards and wings fly around the perimeter of play, dribbling, passing, taking longer shots. Jokic can do all these things. He can also take the ball in a handoff outside the three-point arc, drive toward the basket, and while misrouting defenders with his eyes, sling the ball across the floor to a player who has materialized in the corner. He can grab a defensive rebound with one hand and, in the same motion, throw an overhand pass to a player racing toward the basket on the other end of the court. He knows where his teammates are going to be before they arrive, and he sends the ball there to meet them. I feel like one thing that a lot of young writers struggle with, and I definitely did coming up, is this idea of being the narrator of your own story and not just going, quote, sentences, but guiding the reader along. This is what Jokic does, and here's how he does it, and this is... Is that something you sort of had in your little arsenal, you know, dating back to your early days of writing, or do you feel like you had to develop a narrative approach?
That's a good question. It's, you know, I'm going to step back and say, like, it's interesting that you hit upon that particular passage, because that's actually one of the passages that I like spent the most time on. And partly because like, that's actually something that I you know, I write often write for the website, and this piece was in the magazine, and they have slightly different audiences. And so I felt like I had to do more kind of like narrative explanatory work writing this piece for the magazine than I would have if, let's say, it had run online. Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of had to explain like basketball, you know?
Do you assume to a certain degree your readers are not people who are following the Denver Nuggets?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Certainly for the magazine, like I said, like, I don't think I would have, I mean, to the kind of like, with the sort of patience that I sort of describe, you know, kind of like, you know, big men and, you know, guards and stuff. I'm not sure I would have needed that. Like, I mean, here's an example of this kind of question of readership. Like, I actually did really want to include this, like, you know, I several times watched live in person Jokic have one assist shy of a triple double. And that is actually something he does so often that has a name. It's called a Sombor double. It says something about him, and what, not just that he's from Sombor, but it's, he's not, you know, stat hunting. Like, there are a lot of guys, like, they're one assist shy, like, they'll get that assist. They're one rebound shy, they will fly in for that rebound, you know, like, and he just doesn't do it. He does it so many times. He's had this like Sombor double so many times that it's almost like, it's almost the opposite. Like, it's almost like a point of pride, you know, I think, yeah, for Denver fans, or for Jokic fans in particular. But like, we had, my editor and I had a lot of debate, like, will they really know what a triple double is? Like, will that land? Because can we assume that the reader knows what a triple double is? And we decided that we could not assume that the reader knows what a triple double is. And we actually, they're like, I think triple doubles are mentioned, and I know that they're mentioned in the piece, and I don't stop and explain them, but they're not like that sort of, that like illustrative anecdote, like, wouldn't have worked if you didn't know what a triple double was, and it would have like slowed down the piece for those people. So I was just like, we're just not going to do that. So I do actually take that kind of like reader into mind, but this like idea of a narrative voice, I mean, that's why I write for the narrative voice. Like, in my 20s, I didn't follow sports very much, to be honest. I did when I was in high school, and when I was a kid, I was a sports fanatic. And then when I was like in my 20s, I didn't watch anything, but I was like reading novels all the time and reading like poetry and like reading biographies and things like that, and trying to write them. And that kind of narrative voice, especially from biography, I guess, and from my work in biography, like, that's where I developed it. Because especially when I was writing about, you know, 19th and 20th century people, early 20th century people, like, I mean, I wasn't building through like dialogue so much. I mean, I was using quotes and archival stuff, but like, partly because our voices were so archaic, it wouldn't have worked to have these like long kind of undigested chunks of text. Like, the narrative was like going to survive or not on the momentum and the quality of my own voice. And that's like how I developed that, I think. And I do definitely carry that into my writing now, or I try to.
Are you a believer in the, we can say it better than they can?
Yes.
I am too, 100%.
Yes, I am.
Does that make us douchebags that we're like, you know, I assume I can paraphrase an athlete's quote 98%. And it's not about athletes, could be a singer, could be a politician. I just think most of the time I can paraphrase a quote better than they can say it.
Well, I think that about any person. Like, I'm not saying like it has anything to do with being an athlete. Like, I think I could paraphrase my own quote. Like, this podcast, I could probably write better than we're saying. I'm sorry. But that's why I have a job. Like, that's why we do what we do. Right. Otherwise I would be a, I don't know, radio star. And I'm not good at that. What I'm good at is like putting a sentence together. So I don't want to sound like vain, but yeah, I can, I the hope is, like, the last great hope for writing is that you can imbue, you know, the words on the page or the screen or whatever with like qualities that are harder to capture. Although, you know, the voice gives different, you know, that kind of like spontaneity and things like that. But yeah, like, I think that athletes or people are often not the best interpreters of their own experience. And often, like, yeah, in the paraphrase, you can sort of bring more things to bear than necessarily what they're saying.
It's almost like, and maybe because you weren't raised as a classical sports writer, it took me a long time to break out of this idea that I don't need to quote people all the time. You know, like, I feel like it when you come through a newspaper and you're covering preps and then you're covering this, it's quote, oh, I need to get a quote. I need to get the coach after. I need to get a player after. And you insert these quotes in your stories that are just really bad quotes. And maybe in a way you never had that sense of obligation.
No, I definitely didn't have that sense of obligation. Yeah. And I think I probably like I err in the opposite direction. Like I should quote more, you know, I should try and get their voices in more. I know that's true. Like I should definitely get more quotes. And if I have a weakness, it's like assuming that I can say it. I definitely think like I should do more of that kind of quote fetching and quote getting and quote using. And maybe I should have had a more robust training, but you know, it's funny. I did grow up in a weird, my like history as a sports writer has encouraged other kind of ways of approaching it.
I know your background. I know Harvard poetry, et cetera, read about you. You get to Grantland. Does it feel like a natural fit for you to be at this sports centric website? Or is this a weird landing spot for a younger you?
Well, it was a funny landing spot, but first of all, I still love sports. Like, and so the kind of opportunity to reimmerse myself in sports was extremely welcome. Like I was not like, oh no, like what am I doing? Sports don't matter. And in fact, like I had wanted to, so in my 20s, when I was reading all these novels and biographies, I wanted to be like a biographer and a literary critic. I wanted to write for the London Review of Books, you know, and I wanted to write about, you know, serious things. And I did write a couple, you know, biographies, but I actually found when I started writing about sports that first of all, there was like a freedom to it and a sense of play that I missed in my other kind of writing. And that actually, I think I was able to bring from, certainly from my second book, I was able to bring some of that sense of freedom and play into the writing when I was doing both of them. I mean, I think it was mutually beneficial. And also like a kind of opportunity to write about serious things that I was forcing on, you know, the quote unquote serious stuff kind of arose naturally in writing about sports, as odd as that sounds. And so it didn't feel odd. It felt like in some ways like, oh, this is actually what I should have been doing all along. I mean, I think the part that felt stranger to me was like the pop culture part of Grantland, because that was something I was able to pick up, like get back into sports very easily. But like, I've seen like a handful of movies in my life, you know, like I just don't know who people are.
I want to throw two things at you real quick, because I just saw these for the first time last week. Have you ever seen The Godfather?
No, I haven't.
Have you ever seen Casablanca?
You know, I probably have seen Casablanca because I can picture that scene with Humphrey Bogart in the casino. Yeah. But I don't know if I've just seen that scene or I don't recall having seen Casablanca.
Are you a pop culture averse, would you say?
I have like a weird allergy to like celebrity. It's one of the reasons I didn't like living in LA. I'm a little bit pop culture averse. I probably like play it up too much. I mean, there's lots of pop culture I really like and I admire a lot of it, but it's just not my thing. And partly like that's a time thing. Like I'm amazed at people who have time for everything, but I don't have time to like, I still like reading, you know, fiction and nonfiction. I still like reading like hardcover books and I have two small kids. But even before I had two small kids, I also like to run and I like to take walks where I don't think about anything. And I like to cook and I like to be with my family and I like to see friends. And like at some point, like something's got to give. And like it's, you know, a movie is what, like 2 hours, and that's not that long, but 2 hours for me is like 2 hours that I could spend reading a book. And that's just what I choose to do. It's like actually very much it's not like one choice is inherently better than the other. It's like one is better for me, and that's what I chose to do.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey. So how was the K-pop store?
It was pretty great. I bought 2 NCT Dream albums, 3 NCT 127 albums, a Yuta Nakamoto poster, a 1984 Michigan Panthers Anthony Carter jersey, a Jungwoo book, a How to Sing Like Jennie Kim instructional manual, and...
Wait. You bought a 1984 Michigan Panthers Anthony Carter jersey at the K-pop store?
Well, actually, I bought it at RoyalRetros.com, kings of the throwback sports merchandise. But then, all the 13-year-old K-pop fanatics surrounded me and started tearing at the fabric while screaming, I love you, Doyoung! I love you, Doyoung! So I opened my own Royal Retros kiosk, and now I'm rich.
This is just too weird.
We K-pop fans never disappoint.
I'm going to go back to Jokic here. Part of the piece. When the game ended, I headed to the Nuggets locker room. Jokic, elusive as ever, wasn't there. But it was easy to spot his locker adorned with 2 small pictures of horses and harness and a red ribbon that his horse Dreamcatcher was given for his first racing win. Next to the locker stood Aaron Gordon, the happy recipient of some of Jokic's most spectacular lobs. Gordon was drafted the same year as Jokic, but was much higher. He was the number 4 pick taken by the Magic. He was and is an exhilarating athlete, but in Orlando, he was something of a disappointment. The team didn't have an orchestrator like Jokic. Gordon had to do too much. Jokic expands a game, Gordon told me, and also shrinks it for his teammate. Very, very fascinated by this. When you go to Denver or you go to a game and you're working on this piece on Jokic and you know you're not going to get Jokic and you can watch a game on TV. So theoretically, you could see the passes rewind, slow-mo, the whole thing on TV or YouTube, whatever. What are you looking for?
That's a great question. And I guess the first thing when I land, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm looking for. You know, just sort of hoping something will stick. It's actually funny because like for another game, when I arrived in Denver, I couldn't find the media entrance. And so I asked this like lady, you know, who was walking, you know, she looked like she knew where she was going. And it turned out to be Mike Malone's sister. Oh. It was the coach's sister. And I knew I wasn't going to get like access to Jokic. And I was like, kind of like, oh, maybe, you know, the team had not been super helpful, to be honest, with getting me access to anyone. And she was so nice. And I told her what I was doing. And she was like, oh, the New Yorker, you know. And then we sort of awkwardly said goodbye, but I didn't want to, I felt like kind of, first of all, I just arrived and I felt it was too awkward to like ask her to, you know, connect me to her brother. And so I was like, ah, you know, missed my chance. And then I run into her again after the game. And she's like, did you get what you wanted? I was like, not yet. And she's like, and I was like, please tell, you know, Mike, if he ever wants to talk to me, talk to the New Yorker. And she said, do you have a card? And I thought she said, do I have a car? And I was like confused. I was like, a car? I was like, I don't have a car. And she's like, and then her mood turned because she'd offered to do me a favor and I was rebuffing her. And she was like, she walked away. And I was like, no, wait, I realized what she'd said after she left. And I was like, a card, I have a card, you know, but it was too late. And so I was like, it's over. I can't get anything. Like I just am the biggest idiot you'll ever meet in your entire life. And I have a failure as a reporter. And it's just like, this piece is like, I might as well call my editor and say, I can't do it after all. So sometimes you don't get what you know, opportunities fall into your lap and you don't get them. But mostly I was just like watching the crowd. I wanted to see him move, you know, in person. And I wanted to see him move off the ball a lot. You know, like often when I'm watching, I mean, I did watch him off the ball a lot, you know, on TV, but like the camera is like trained on the action, you know. Sure. I wanted to watch him and only him for an entire game. Also, I wanted to watch like shoot-arounds. You know, kind of how he warms up, like what he does, how he interacts with teammates, that kind of stuff. You notice crowd, like how many people are wearing Jokic jerseys or, you know, what's the energy or that you can't really get on the screen. And then, yeah, like I knew a press conference was going to be my only time to ask him a question. So that was important. And then the locker room, I was like hoping to catch him, but I never did. But mostly we're just looking at just like I'm just like open to things. I'm just not actually necessarily looking for anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just like trying to just see what like strikes me. And definitely what struck me was like these two pictures in this ribbon, you know, it was so like perfect. Like, how could I not notice that? To some extent, you just have to be like, just have a kind of like openness, I think, on these things.
I feel like traveling to Denver from the East Coast to see the pictures of the horses in his locker is 100% worth it. No, I think it's 100% worth it. I think those details, I mean, I just think 99% of reporters are looking at Jokic's stat sheet.
This is actually what's amazing to me, because like, to me, those are like the most kind of like vivid, like this, if you need to know who Jokic is, like here's a portrait. You know, what else do you need to know? It's all there. And I was like trying to the fact checker, because I didn't take a picture of the pictures, you know? I was like trying to send like evidence, you know, someone saying this in a profile, and like people don't use these details, that kind of detail. It's amazing. It was amazing to me how many of these kind of like small details haven't been used before, you know, that we're sort of somehow like quote unquote new, even though obviously how many people have like watched him. Thomas Beller actually did write differently than I did, but write him, you know, blowing on his hands. But when you're watching him in a shoot around, like he's just constantly doing this. Like, it's like the only thing that stands out. Like, yeah, I could describe his routine to you, like what he, you know, how he goes through his progressions. But like the thing that like stands out is he's just like, it's like, he's like a, you know, like I don't know, warming them up, or I was like, is he warming them up or cooling them down or drying them off? I think he's drying them off. But that kind of thing, like, seems like when you think about how important his hands are, like, what's he doing with his hands? He's blowing them constantly. Like, that just seems like, like, it's just right there. And like, it's always surprising to me that more people don't use those details.
You know what I think people miss all the time? Tattoos. I think tattoos tell the best stories. And it's amazing how few journalists say to a guy, why do you have a tattoo of a dog on your arm?
Well, it's funny. I wrote a story about a soccer player, Sydney LaRue. And I like kind of tried to build her in around her tattoos somewhat. And this is years ago when I was at Grantland. And I actually got a lot of pushback.
Oh, no. Wait, why?
Yeah. I don't know. They were like such a cliche, you know, like how her tattoos, you know, you're reading so much in these tattoos. And maybe it had, maybe there was some like misogyny in that. Like it was focusing on a woman's tattoos or something. I don't know. But like, yeah, I remember being like, huh, maybe that's, maybe it's too, the overriding like response was like, oh, that's such a cliche. And I was like, oh, maybe it's such a cliche. I'm so cliched. So I haven't like, actually, I was like a little chastened by that, but maybe I'll go back to the
I just think if you think about it, like you're putting something on your body permanently.
Yeah. Permanent, yeah.
It almost always has to have some meaning. Most people, unless you're a complete idiot, aren't putting like the Coors Beowulf on their shoulder. You know, there's a reason for doing it. Well, you ended the story. Okay. So one of Jokic's youth coaches died, and he died. He was assistant coach of the Warriors. You ended the piece. The Warriors were postponed their next two games. The Nuggets went to Boston to play the Celtics, who are undefeated at home, having won 20 straight. That evening, in front of the Garden, a frigid wind whipped down Causeway Street. About 90 minutes before the game started, Jokic came out of the tunnel that leads to the court and found a chair. He sat by himself for a long time. Then he walked onto the floor, drifted in a few hook shots, and settled into his routine. When the game began, he tripped on the Nuggets' first possession, losing the ball. On the second, he missed a shot near the basket. On the third, he flew a pass out of bounds. Then he began to control the tempo. He made 7 of his next 8 shots and assumed his usual role as the game's center of gravity. He played nearly 40 minutes, and the Nuggets won by 2. Afterward, Jokic declined to speak. End of story. Here's my question. I'm not accusing you of anything. I swear to God, I just want to say, I feel like reading the piece, you're sort of assuming or thinking that he probably, the connection, his coach just died. He's sitting there. He's quietly on the bench. Is it possible he's thinking about a Simpsons episode he watched last night?
100%. That's why I do not say thinking, sitting out by himself, like grieving. You know, I don't have, you know, as well as I do. I am just giving you what I saw. So I'm not giving you what I think he was thinking. Like, if you read that again, like there's no suggest that I'd never say that this is what he was thinking. It's just the context. And that's what I'm giving you. I'm giving you what he did. And this is the context. So that's something I try to be very careful about. Because like it is manipulative writing, of course, is suggestive that this is an important moment. And it was an important moment. Like, you know, this person was incredibly important to him and he had just died. And, you know, it's the fact that the Warriors postponed their next two games, you know, the Warriors had been scheduled to play that night and they didn't because they were so shaken by it, by his death. Here's someone who like, this is like his mentor. This is the person he said he wanted to be. And Jokic still has to go out and play. And he doesn't have like the community of, you know, like the Warriors, when they played again, they had this ceremony. They were crying, you know, they were hugging each other. Like Jokic didn't have anyone to like hug in that moment. He was by himself and he sat by himself, you know? And so that was the original ending. And then 2 nights later or the night later, I don't remember. He went to Washington, had an amazing game, triple-double, you know, et cetera. And afterward, he said he didn't want to talk about Dan. He didn't want to make a circus of it. And he just wanted to say that he loved him. He was just like, I loved him. There was at one point where that was the end of the piece. And we ended up keeping it just tight, you know, on the Celtics game, which I think worked. But I actually kind of missed the I loved him moment. But it is suggestive in a way that might be unfair. Like you could say like, and maybe he would read that and say like, dude, I wasn't actually crying. I wasn't grieving. I was thinking about the Simpsons or Friends. He loves Friends. I was thinking about, you know, Jennifer Aniston, whatever. And that's totally possible. And that's like the risk you take when you're a writer. If you try to suggest any kind of like, you know, have any kind of like psychological import. And that's always like a huge gamble. And yeah, dangerous. You know, it's funny because you know, I talked to you about this like writing course I'm teaching. And for the first class, I signed actually Gary Smith's story about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And also this J. Caspian King story about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, written much later, written 5 years ago or something. And it's like they're describing the same person, but they're two human, different human beings, like two almost different species of human being. Yeah. And the Gary Smith one, this is a story of like softening and, you know, kind of like, you know, this guy who's had such a hard, has felt so alienated from so much of society. And he's just finally opened up and, you know, found comfort and family and, you know, inability to laugh at himself and all these things. And then it's like, as if that story never happened, like when you get to the J. King story. And so partly I wanted to show that, like, you know, the way you tell a story really matters, and you might be capturing the truth in any given moment, you know, but like, that doesn't mean you are capturing like the person, you know. It's just like, there's a kind of, you know, there's always a kind of danger to wrapping someone up in a narrative. And so, yeah, I don't purport to say like, I know what Jokic was thinking in that moment. And I was very careful not to say what I thought he was thinking. I was just careful to say, this is what I saw.
Who do you teach for?
For Harvard.
Can you teach people how to write well? Is it possible to take someone who's not really a good writer, doesn't know how to write, blah, blah, blah. They take Louise's class and all of a sudden they're a good writer.
I will say that every single student I have taught has written at least one good thing for me. And in most cases, it's like what they do at the end. So I don't know if like that's coincidental, and it could be. It could also be that I'm better at assigning, like giving better prompts as the semester goes on, because it's a big part of it, you know. Actually, I'm better at giving guidance about what I want to get, so it could be a me problem and not a like their progression. But yeah, I absolutely think you can learn to write. Like, these are all skills, like, to develop, like, and they're also just, I mean, some of them are not even skills, they're just like, no one thinks to try, you know, no one thinks to like what to look for, or like what to write for, or whatever. But we'll see. I don't know. I mean, it's a new adventure every semester. So
I teach out here at a university, and every now and then I have a student and I just think, I don't know. Like, I don't know. Somehow it doesn't. You never have that where it goes in one ear.
Oh, yeah. Oh, but I will say, some of those students, I actually end up being like my favorite, because like they surprise me, actually. Right. I'm just like, you're unteachable. And then they produce something. And it's often because they do something totally. It turns out that when they try to be funny, or like they let themselves be funny, then that's when they have like more authentic voice, or more freedom in their writing or something. And they're trying to be serious. It's just like all of the jumble just kind of stands in the place of any kind of life. So part of it is like that, getting them to access like whatever kind of natural voice they have. But yeah, of course. I mean, I do think that there are really some really bad writers in the world. So it's just, it stands to reason and make your way into your classroom. And there are also people who like don't really want to learn, you know, so that's always a struggle.
I'm required to ask you as a final question on this podcast, what is the best either confrontation you've had with a subject, or someone's been mad at you, journalist, reporter?
This is actually why I shouldn't be a journalist. I don't even call myself a journalist.
I call you one on this podcast, though. So.
Well, the reason I don't is that I'm so unconfrontational that like, I don't consider myself a legitimate journalist because I'm so scared of people. What is the best confrontation that I've had with someone? I've had someone as fact checkers. Joe Biden got really mad at me when I was a fact checker.
Wait, what happened? I love a good Joe Biden's mad at me.
I was checking a profile of him, and there was an anecdote that he was displeased to hear was going to be in the story, and he like yelled at me, but it was fine. It ended up being fine. You know, it's funny. I don't usually write. I try to write stories actually about, and maybe this is like, I do care about like being sharp when I need to be sharp, but I do try to like write from a place of like joy and love. So I don't actually usually, first of all, I don't usually hear from my subjects unless I like request it. So I don't really have one.
Well, let me ask you a final question then.
Sure.
You're on Twitter and you seem like the least likely journalist to be on Twitter. You literally have never seen a movie. I mean, you have seen a movie, but you don't watch movies. You don't care about pop culture. You seem like you're very dedicated to the craft and also your time and using every minute. And yet you actually are on Twitter.
Yeah.
Explain that one to me.
So Twitter is actually kind of useful for me because I see how people, one of the ways I like quote unquote report is see how people are talking about something. And I often write against that or off that or incorporate that. So it's like useful for me to sort of see like, what are people talking about? I mean, Twitter gives me like hives. I don't try to be funny on it usually. And when I do, it just makes me sad. And I don't have a lot of followers. So I'm not very successful at Twitter. I do post like my stories, but I have made like a couple of like friends actually on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Like one of my closest friends here, actually, we like connected through Twitter. And so for that alone, it's been a reason to be on it, but I'm always like swearing off it. I don't have the app on my phone or anything. I don't spend time on it.
I actually think we first connected on Twitter. I was just scrolling
back. Exactly.
This podcast. There you go.
This is why I'm on Twitter. I always tell myself I'm going to get off, but.
Oh, so Elon Musk is such a good guy. I just want to support that guy. So I want to
exactly.
Help.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to help Elon. Yeah. Well, listen, Louisa, seriously, I love this story. I think it's great. It was art. Loved it. Love your work. Very much appreciate you doing this.
I had fun. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank today's guest, Louisa Thomas, for joining me on Two Riders Sling and Yang. You can follow Louisa on Twitter at Louisa H. Thomas and read her work in The New Yorker. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Sling and Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the sizzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. Remember, keep riding.